Hey, so I'm taking a quick break as I'm working on the Female CEO project on work culture and belonging. More on that soon, but if you know of people that have just come to your mind, please make sure you reach out and connect me. In the meantime, I wanted to re-air this episode with David McCraney, host of the podcast You Are Not So Smart, and best-selling author of the newly released book to massive critical acclaim, How to Change Minds. I thought it was the perfect time to revisit this conversation as the political claws come out in our nation and we try and fight back on important topics like Roe v. Wade overturning and gun laws and the disagreements that we have in our families and our communities. I mean, imagine having a blueprint of how to actually change people's minds. Also, big fat thank you to Pearl Chang and Jasirius Torres, who have joined the Culture Changers Patreon level at the Stone Cold Culture Changer and Let's Do This levels. I'm so incredibly grateful for your support online and offline. Y'all are awesome. If you'd like to support the show and get some major perks, including ad-free episodes and a private community focused on changing the culture, you can become a member at patreon.com/culturechangers. Here's my chat with David McCraney.
As you can imagine, like three people on a hill, and if we're all looking in one direction, none of us can see what's going on behind us. If all three of us look in different directions, we have a nice world view of what's going on. But to do that, I have to really trust the person next to me is going to accurately deliver to me what they're seeing from their perspective. And in turn, in a reciprocal relationship, I'm going to tell them what I'm seeing.
Ooh, I've been waiting for this one. How do you change someone's mind? Think about it politically, personally, culturally. Can you change someone's mind about conspiratorial thinking? So I stumbled on this podcast last summer called You Are Not So Smart, which is hilarious in the title. And it was an episode about vaccine hesitancy. And what struck me about this episode was that it was the first show I ever heard where it not only identified the problem of why we're so divided in our beliefs, but gave a very detailed breakdown with seven different experts on how to change someone's deep-seated beliefs. It literally broke down how to solve the problem. I hadn't heard that anywhere else. I've heard tons of podcasts talking about the problem, but not like, where do we go from here? How do we solve it? And it was just great. And so this podcast, the host, David McCraney, dives deep into the psychology behind why people believe what they believe and how to change it, how, like, the art of persuasion. So once again, my brain lit up like a firefly, and I was determined to have him come on Culture Changers. And you know what? He broke it all down for us today. David McCraney is a science journalist and an internationally best-selling author, podcaster, lecturer, and he created the You Are Not So Smart podcast, the book, and the blog. He also wrote the books You Are Now Less Dumb and How to Beat Your Brain, and has his new book called How Minds Change, all about the surprising science of belief, opinion, and persuasion. I love the description. What leads reasonable, intelligent, scientifically curious people to believe the earth is flat? Self-delusion expert and psychology nerd David McCraney sets out to discover not just what it takes to influence others, but why we believe it in the first place. Anyway, make sure you text this podcast out to your most curious friends immediately. And while you do that, are you on my weekly email list yet? Go to allisonhair.com, leave me your email there for more personal updates directly from me. Here is my chat with David McCraney. Got to start right out of the gate. So you are an ex-conspiracy theorist, had a big YouTube following.
I wasn't an ex-conspiracy theorist. Let's not do that part.
Oh, okay. I totally had that wrong.
Yeah. I mean, it was just because I was telling you the story probably in a mushy kind of way. I was surrounded by people who had, I was fascinated by conspiracy theorists and surrounded by people who have, like everybody else, family members who are conspiracy theorists. But more than that, I was doing shows about conspiratorial thinking in which I was being very cynical. I was telling people like, yeah, this is the kind of person that you should understand. This is the kind of thinking you should understand. Be careful, don't fall into this, because once you're in it, there's no way out. And I'm sorry if you're trying to help and change people in your lives, but you know, there's a place that once they cross that line, it's like, you know, becoming a vampire or something. Once they, once they've been bitten, it's over.
Yeah, and now that's a really interesting. Yeah.
But I remember very clearly my sort of incepting moment. I was invited to do a lecture with Ogilvy, and they have a division called Ogilvy Change, and this is a big PR company. They do things like the commercial, like, do you remember those old Dove commercials where they didn't tell you how good the product was. They sort of emphasized the lifestyle of a person who would be a consumer of Dove.
Yeah.
And they consumed a lot. They emphasized body positivity before that was sort of a term, that sort of thing. So that's what that division works on. And I did a lecture there, and in the Q&A, someone said, I have a family member who believes Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States and they're a birther. They think the birth certificate, it's fake. How do I help this person see the truth? And I remember being very cynical and saying to that person, well, you just can't. But I also felt really gross when I did that. I felt like, it seems like I don't like giving cynical advice, especially about change. But I was giving that kind of advice. And then at the same time that was happening, the norms in the United States about same-sex marriage, about LGBTQ rights in general, were changing very rapidly. And I had grown up in Mississippi, where there was still intense bigotry toward LGBT people. And I had seen it firsthand with family members and friends, people who were closeted and fighting for their rights in the best way they could. And when everything changed, it changed so fast that it was just intensely fascinating to me. Like I had to wrestle with the fact that, oh no, people definitely can change their minds about things that they thought they were absolutely certain about. Mm-hmm. And I got a book about rapid social changes, and it was a political science book. And in the book, it outlined changes like, during suffrage, during civil rights, during the early days of the LGBT movements. It outlined things like marijuana laws and tobacco, even like hemlines and like facial hair and stuff like that. And there was this pattern in all of the changes, which was you have this long, steady status quo, and then a very rapid shift in public opinion, and then a new status quo. And this shift kept happening, and it looked just like something I'd already read about and knew a little bit about, called punctuator equilibrium, which is in biology, when there's no pressure to change, it can seem like species are stable. And then when the environment changes, the species change in response almost immediately, and you end up with punctuated equilibrium. And all that's fascinating from a political science sociology perspective, and I talk about it in the book, but what I wanted to know was, like, what's going on in people's brains? Like, what happens in your brain when you change your mind? What happens in your brain when you resist changing your mind? And when we do change our minds in ways in which we look back and can't believe that we ever believed, felt, or behaved in a way that we don't do today, what has happened? Like, what has changed? And so that became this intense obsession. And I start that obsession with conspiracy theorists. So the book begins by going into 9/11 truther world, which is people who believe that 9/11 was an inside job and that the buildings were, you know, they had explosives inside of them and the government blew them up and everything. And the people on board the airplanes weren't real and all sorts of stuff like that. And I just went deep into that world because I had found someone there who had drastically changed their minds and had left that world. And I wanted to understand through their story what was going on. And the reason I had to do that was because when I approached psychologists from doing the podcast for so long, I had a nice bank of people I could reach out to, and they could lead me to other experts that I wasn't familiar with. When I asked them, hey, can you tell me how people change their minds and what was the psychology behind the change in norms of same-sex marriage, I kept getting the same answer. He's like, we don't know. Like, you're talking about, this is like, that's the bleeding edge of social science. This is something that you can find people researching it, but I can't give you a definite answer. And then I found a belief researcher who had studied belief for 40 plus years. And I asked, hey, could you define the word belief for me? Like, to explain it to me like a five-year-old. And I remember him leaning back in his chair and being like, oh, well, that's a tough one. I'm like, this is what you've studied for 40 years.
The word belief, yeah.
And he said, that's why it's difficult to define that word. And so I realized that I couldn't just do something. I couldn't do that sort of toe-tapping, hacky sort of science writing where it's just Wikipedia with jokes, where you just go read a bunch of research papers and tell people what they say. I was going to have to go out into the world and sort of experience people who have changed their minds drastically, activist groups who people change their minds on purpose, persuasion experts who persuade and teach persuasion, and then bring that back to experts and say, what was happening here? What's going on here? And that actually worked. And it made my editors are very happy that I actually yeah. came up with a way to do this after pitching this idea. And so that's how the book goes. I spend time with people change their mind in drastic ways. I go to Westboro Baptist Church and talk to people. Oh, I went to Westboro.
I love cults. Bring on all the cults.
I went to Westboro Baptist Church's Valentine's Day services. And then afterward, I went to the Rainbow House, which is across the street. It's a halfway house for LGBT youth. And they bought a house across from Westboro and painted it rainbow.
Wow.
And then I spent time with people who had left Westboro Baptist Church, Megan Phelps Roper, Zach Phelps. And asked them, you know, what happened in your life that led you to change? I asked former conspiracy theorists, how did you change your mind? What were the circumstances? And then I went to people I went to groups of people who changed minds professionally. And that's when the real epiphanies began, because I spent time with, and I'll talk about these in detail. I just want to give you a little overview. I spent time with people in Los Angeles who engage in something called deep canvassing. They go door to door and knock on people's doors and change people's minds about or influence their attitudes about wedge issues. I spent time with street epistemology people there. Those are people that started in Texas, but they're around the world now, and they have a method for shifting perspectives on things that works really well.
Street epistemology is fascinating. So I learned about that from your vaccine hesitancy. Yeah, I had to literally write it down because I'd never heard of it and figure out how to spell it. But then I started watching the videos of how you break down somebody's belief. And I think what's interesting about that, if I could pause for a minute, David,
go ahead.
Is that when the way the political division has pitted us in a way that you have to be on the extreme. So your view is that the other person, the person that doesn't agree with you, is on the extreme. And so from a street epistemology perspective, asking the question on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely are you to get a vaccine or not? And a lot of the answers seem to be so much more surprising when you are not coming at it from a place of judgment, but asking where they are. And, you know, if you're a 4, what would, you know, why are you a 4 instead of a 1? You know, like what would bring it up higher? Can you explain a little bit about that science behind that? Because I think, you know, when we're thinking about changing people's minds, I think we desperately want to connect with each other, but we feel so polarized. We feel forced to be polarized, you know, like to have to be in one camp or the other.
Yeah. Well, the thing, so I, all these groups, there was street epistemology, deep canvassing, and smart politics, some others. And the thing that fascinated me initially was that these groups had never met each other. Some of them had no experience with the underlying science behind what they were doing. Yet they all had come up with methods that were almost identical. And the steps, even if the steps were interpreted a little differently, or they had different wording, they were the same order. And what I kept thinking was, like, this is like if you're trying to build the first airplane, no matter where you build it on Earth, it's going to look kind of the same, because physics is the same wherever you are on the planet. And it seemed pretty obvious to me that the underlying mechanisms that are taking place in a human brain during a persuasive attempt are going to be roughly the same. So that means there must be some universality, which means there has to be a science behind it. And that's what led me finally back to finding people who could explain it and give me all the particulars. Now, that ended up being like 300,000 words of material that had to be cut down to roughly 100,000. Because you could write 100 books about this once you start getting into it, because each element of it is very complex and nuanced and has its own genealogy of ideas. With these persuasive techniques, what it boils down to is technique rebuttal versus topic rebuttal. Before I can explain that, let me lay a couple of foundational principles. One is, when you want to change somebody's mind, the most important question you need to ask is why. You need to ask a question of yourself first, which is, why is this something you want to do? If you don't understand the motivations behind your desire to shift somebody else's attitude, change their confidence in a belief, or rearrange their value system, I would consider what you're doing to be it could drift into the realm of coercion.
How do you assess why, though? How do you assess whether it is a coercion versus, you know, like this is for the good of the greater good, or is this because I feel alone in my?
This is why I want people to ask that question first, because I feel these tools are very powerful, and I feel like it would be unethical and immoral to hand these tools over to someone who hasn't asked themselves first, what is their intention? What is their motivation? What is the purpose behind what they're doing? Because people who disagree with you likely also feel they're doing it. Their mission is to create more good in the world. Mm-hmm. And that means that you might get into a situation where you're in a debate, and the problem with the debate is that there's a winner and a loser, and nobody wants to be a loser. And the problem with the debate is that the idea is that, this is my cat, Simon, he wants to be part of this. The idea with the debate also is, what you're trying to get to at the end of it is, I'm right and you're wrong. Mm-hmm. And if you get to that point, you feel like everything is concluded. What's missing from that, though, is the possibility that we're both wrong, or that we're both right, but seeing it from two different perspectives. And you will never get to that if you get stuck into the debate frame. You have to stay in the conversation frame, but probably it's better worded as stay in the "we're trying to solve a mystery together" frame.
That seems
and the mystery
so hard,
is what
though.
Is the truth, right? So the way to get into that is first. So after you've asked this question yourself of why do you want to do this, which just helps you get into a more like to get into this frame for yourself, ask yourself what it is that you want to change, because the phrase "change someone's mind" is poorly defined. Some cultures don't even have this phrase. I say in the book to focus on three aspects of human psychology, which would be attitudes, beliefs, and values. And we can define these very simply, which is, an attitude is a valenced emotional response to a concept. So it's a positive or negative emotional reaction to an idea. If I say, home baked apple pie, they like if you think that is a good thing, that is, you have a positive attitude toward this thing.
Yeah.
If I say industrial medical waste, you probably think, oh, that's not something I want to have at Thanksgiving, and you have a negative attitude toward that. So positive and negative, they're valenced, and you can, because we're complex, nuanced human beings, have both positive and negative emotions about a concept. So you would have ambivalence, you'd be ambivalent. And it's important, just as they say in Girl Interrupted, ambivalence, you know, this does not mean you're in the middle. This means you are both. You feel both. And we can do that. So that's an attitude. You might want to shift someone's attitude on something. If they think something that is good, you think is bad, or vice versa. Mm. This is something that it's easy to get stuck in these words and get sort of in kind of get you find yourself slogging through a semantic swamp of like definitions. If you're not careful, because people will often say they want to change someone's mind about, let's say in politics, like the president, you believe the president, this is a good president, and I want to show you how they're not. That's not a belief. That's an attitude. Like, that my feeling toward the president is an attitude. And the method of change shifting someone's attitude is going to be different from shifting someone's beliefs.
Oh, now, my God. That's so nuanced.
Right. So the belief. No, this attitude is likely supported by beliefs, but the avenue toward shifting the attitude, you might intuitively assume, will be, I need to change these person's beliefs that support that attitude, and I'm going to knock down these facts they think are facts with my better facts. But that's not necessarily so. Their attitude may be driven by something completely outside of belief and factual stuff. Their attitude might be driven by identity. The attitude might be driven by motivations that are outside of the realm of fact-based conclusions. So that's important.
Can I pause for a second there too? Because I think what I learned from, you know, some of your podcast episodes is that when you try and attack somebody with facts, so this makes sense in terms of like the attitude, the beliefs, all of those. But when you try and attack somebody with more facts, like I'm going to send you a video and you're going to see the way I see that, like if you have somebody who is big into MSNBC and you say, you know what, I need you to watch Fox News, just watch it for one day, you actually become more embedded in your own, you know, your original belief systems, that it actually has the opposite effect. Is that true? And how do you explain that?
It's context, it's person and context dependent, but that does often take place.
Yeah.
And that's usually because, you know, well, okay, I'll get into that. Let me, do not forget David McCraney. We're going to talk about reasoning. Okay. So reasoning's next.
Okay.
Very quickly, a belief is a level of confidence in a fact-based statement. So, you know, it's a feeling. Like, that's strange to, I think a lot of people like to say we have to separate facts from feelings. That's impossible. Brains don't work that way. You have an emotional response that is just as outside of your control as feeling pain when you stub your toe, when you think about a concept that may or may not be true, and you feel a level of confidence about that. If I tell you today is Tuesday and you feel like, I don't think it's Tuesday, I think it's Friday, like your confidence in the state, your confidence level is different, right? If you walk outside and see some mud puddles outside your front door, and you think it must have rained, and you have some sort of confidence, emotional response that is this confidence in this fact-based statement, but then you see it, there's a pipe has burst in the road and there's a leak, your confidence in that fact-based concept goes down, your confidence in this other concept goes up. Beliefs are sort of this sliding scale of confidence and propositional concepts. And then a value is just like the hierarchy of things where we think we should be putting our money, our effort, our time. For some people, that should be for eliminating one problem and not another, or should the money that we put out to solve problems should go to this cause and not this cause. So that's a value. And all these things can be rearranged, and they all interplay. Attitudes or have relationships with beliefs and values, and vice versa, and all around. It's a whole big mixy mess of brain goop doing stuff. And a lot of times categorizing this stuff and defining it is just for just helps us talk about it more than it actually illustrates that these things are separate from one another in a categorical way. Okay, so here's the problem that most people have. When you get into an argument with someone over anything, whether it's their attitude, belief, or value, the intuitive thing to do is say, hey, have you read this? Have you seen this? Let me give you some links. Will you watch this video? Will you read this book? That's not what this person says. Well, this expert, blah, blah, blah. And also, that's what they're going to do. They're going to say, well, here's my expert, and here are my facts, here are my things. And you end up having this proxy battle of hyperlinks what's happening there psychologically is you're battling each other at the level of your conclusions. And conclusions are just that. That's the conclusion. That is when the processing chain, the very immense long chain of processing of human brain goes through before it settles on what it's going to think, feel, and believe, concludes with this nugget of, you know, transient confidence or attitude. And we're fighting each other at that level, which is means we're not fighting each other at the level of how we reach those conclusions, which it's, I can't change your conclusion. It has concluded. It is done. And if we're having this battle, we're not even having a discussion at all. We're just throwing stuff at each other. And the reason we do that is because of something in psychology called naive realism. Naive realism is the sort of a catch-all term for the natural intuitive assumption that the way we think is the way to think. And that if anyone had seen the facts that we've seen, if anyone had the experiences we've had in life, they would naturally come to the same conclusions we've come to, because how could they not? Which means all I have to do to get you to see things my way is expose you to the things that I assume you must not have been exposed to. And once you've been exposed to those things, you will naturally see things the way that I do. This is our immediate intuitive response. And it almost never works, because other people are motivated in by things that we're not motivated by. Like, they're their own person, and they may have a different identity that's at stake. They may have a different group that they're worried about being ostracized from. They may have financial obligations that we don't. They may have personal traumas that are so outside of the domain of our understanding that we're totally blind to the idea that these things could be things. And if they're not, that means that their way of reasoning is not our way of reasoning. And what you're asking a person to do when you hand them these facts, figures, and links, and hope that they just naturally snap into the way you see, is you're expecting to copy paste your reasoning into their brain, which is impossible. That's an act. Like, they have to actually reason their way. They have to go all the way back to the beginning, go through their processing chain, and produce a new conclusion. So the only persuasive techniques that work are the ones that task and challenge the other person and yourself in the process of going through a new chain of processing or a new chain of reasoning. So that brings us to the big idea of reasoning.
Reasoning. Now you,
Okay.
now we're back there.
I'm a
Perfectly done.
tangent dancing dude. Reasoning. So this is a very important principle. In there's such a thing called reasoning. In if you have any experience with philosophy or logic or argumentation or politics, you've probably come across the concept of this big R reason, propositions. See, like old Socrates stuff, like all men have beards. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates has a beard. That kind of thing. So this is propositional logic, and
Interesting.
there's all sorts of things in reason, and reason can be written out, and it's got its own language that looks like math, and it's a real thing. Logic and reason is beautiful, and it's an important concept of math and science and philosophy. It exists. That is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, in psychology, we don't talk about reason. Like, we talk about reasoning, and the two can get conflated. Reasoning is literally just coming up with reasons for what you think, feel, and believe. And through the help of two immense researchers, and I cannot recommend this book enough, it's called The Enigma of Reason by Hugo Mercier and Dan Sperber. Hugo Mercier was incredibly helpful for putting together How Minds Change. I interviewed him many times and asked him many questions, and it broke everything open for me once I saw this one aspect of things, which is, there was, in the early days of writing about this sort of pop psychology stuff, this and these books still float around. There was this sort of this like feverish like indictment of human beings that said we are flawed and irrational. And you look at all sorts of things, from locking your keys in your car to sending an email to all the people you didn't to your entire company instead of to your proctologist. There's all sorts of stuff that we can say, like, look how flawed and irrational we are. And it's also very easy to point fingers at at people doing weird stuff in the world that we think is strange, or believing strange stuff, and say, well, that's because they are flawed and irrational. Hugo Mercier and Dan Sperber don't like that, and I don't like it either now that I've sort of fully ingratiated myself into their world. It's not that we're flawed and irrational reasoners, it's that we're just biased and lazy. And that makes total sense, because from an evolutionary standpoint, one of the things that we gained as an advantage as a species is the ability to communicate. And there's a whole beautiful science and a lot of hypotheses about how this took place. But once we could exchange information with one another through spoken language, written language, and so on, that gave us the ability to organize toward collective goals in a way we never could before. And one of the most beneficial parts of that is, you can imagine like three people on a hill, and if we're all looking in one direction, none of us can see what's going on behind us. If all three of us look in different directions, we have a nice world view of what's going on. But to do that, I have to really trust the person next to me is going to accurately deliver to me what they're seeing from their perspective. And in turn, in a reciprocal relationship, I'm going to tell them what I'm seeing. Even in the best of circumstances, people can be wrong. They can be incorrect about what they're seeing. Or they could have like not a whole lot of experience, and they could be seeing it and delivering it to you accurately, but their experience like leads them to infer things that you wouldn't infer, or an expert wouldn't infer. So that's one thing that introduces a problem in that. But the other thing that introduces a problem is they could lie. They could mislead you to their for their own ends. So once we developed the ability to communicate in this way, and we had all these incredible advantages because as a group we could see things more clearly than we could as individuals, they call this the trust bottleneck, which is that when a individual says, no, I don't think we should do it this way, or I see things differently, or I wish to affect the attitudes, values, beliefs of the people in my group, the trust bottleneck that would appear is that if everyone was too cynical or too guarded against misinformation, then we wouldn't be able to change our minds when we really needed to. And that's important for when you're trying to survive in environments from, prehistory. So we developed the we actually literally evolved the ability to argue. And then so argumentation is something that's very unique to human beings. We can persuade other people to see things our way. I think I even have yes, this is a direct quote from the book. The ability to change our minds, update our priors, and entertain other points of view is one of our greatest strengths and evolved ability that comes free with every copy of the human brain. And the point here is that because we have this system, the only way you're going to persuade people effectively is if we return to the system, if we play on what the evolved response prefers, right? So all that out in the way, what I'm trying to say is reasoning is coming up with the reasons for what you think, feel, and believe. And that's really important in one of these environments because I want to persuade you that that my perspective is a good perspective, and that my suggestion is a good suggestion, which means I'm going to try to generate reasons that are plausible. And plausible means things that people in my trusted peer group would consider justified. So, yeah, when we argue our cases, we do so in a way where we try to justify things, rationalize things, and we try to do so in a way that we intuitively understand this will persuade people in my trusted peer group because I don't want to be ostracized from that group or kicked out. And this sets up all the ways that we generate very biased and lazy reasoning. And lazy, the bias part is from our individual perspective and with all these identity goals in place. But the lazy part is we always try to do the most justifiable thing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Can I tell you about a little study that demonstrates this? It's one of my favorite studies. Is that okay? I just want to ask
of
your
course.
Permission
because
I feel like because I'm in ramble mode. So there's this great study that demonstrates how we want justification is such a thing. It's an old Tversky study. They had people flip a coin. Well, they didn't actually flip a coin. They got a sheet of paper that said you have flipped a coin, and if it comes up heads, you win $100. If it comes up tails, you lose $100, and you start out, I think, with $300 virtually. And then some people it goes one way, some people it goes another. Then they ask, if I present this to you again, would you take the same gamble? Depending on the and some people they it went heads, some people went tails. Everyone chooses to flip again. And when they ask why would you do that? This is the moment when these systems come online. This is the reasoning system coming online. I now need to produce a reason for what I have said I'm going to do. And people who it came up in their favor, they said, I want to flip the coin again because I'm ahead, so I can risk it. People who lost the flip, they said, I want to flip again because I need to win back what I lost. So win or lose, people can come up with a justification for continuing to play because they just are motivated to keep playing. And there's a whole reason for that, which is just the way that the brain works in a gambling situation. It doesn't matter. They want to play again. Win or lose, you can come up with a justification to do so. So when we want to do something, we can come up with a justification for it. But it needs to be plausible to the person who's asking the question. So here's the crazy part of this experiment. They run it again, but they don't tell people the outcome of the flip. So they tell you, you have flipped a coin and it has come up heads or it has come up tails, but I'm not going to reveal it to you until you tell me, would you like to flip again? And in this scenario, more than 80% of people will not flip the coin.
Mm.
Now, we already know from the first run that it doesn't even matter what it comes up. You're going to choose to flip again. But if I don't give you the information you can use as a justification, you will not make a decision because you can't. All decisions, we don't make the decision that has the best. We don't make the decision that has the most information behind it. We don't make the decision that is best. We make the decision that is easiest to justify. And that is where the laziness comes in. We will always choose the easiest justification for our arguments in that reasoning dynamic. So all this comes together as into one point, which is when you're arguing with someone and you're in a persuasive context, what's actually happening here are two brains using their reasoning sort of psychological mechanisms of reasoning to attempt to produce justifications for their current feelings and thoughts, behaviors, actions, or for some sort of future plan or goal, which means that a proper effective persuasive technique is going to engage that reasoning system, not the what it's going to start it from the beginning and move it back through its processing chain, not at the end. And that brings us to the two concepts which I highlight in the book: topic rebuttal versus technique rebuttal. There are two ways to engage in this. I feel like I need to like take a second so that you can say something. I'll get into topic and technique and tell you, I'll give you some practical advice. But I'm interested to see if you have any thoughts or questions.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about this is that there's so many complicated nuances. So I'm thinking about, you know, how you're explaining this, and I'm thinking about applying it in our everyday life. So if it is convincing my husband that we need to go on this trip, we need to, you know, switch gears or switch schools for our kids, something like that, you know, and having an opposing opinion. But then you have, you know, really real life situations of family members, of friends that disagree with you wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. On that. So understanding the logic, the reasoning, the belief system, you know, I'm curious to know about the social identities and how impactful is that? You've mentioned this a number of times.
Yeah.
You know, of how much that weighs in. And in that vaccine hesitancy, it was repeated over and over again that just opened my eyes and put all kinds of floodlights behind it the phrase, social death is far greater than physical death. So how important,
I'm with you.
How important are social identities?
Okay. So
when it comes to reasoning, changing people's minds,
there are a bazillion studies in sort of the 1950s, 60s, 70s of social science into sort of social identity. There was that generation of psychologists were trying to understand what was going on with like the Nazis, basically. They're like, how did that happen? And they did a lot of research into coercion. They did a lot of research into falling in line and appeals to authority, that sort of thing, conformity. And a lot of that research came to some of the stuff, you know, has been replicated. And it's, if you took a psychology class a long time ago, I hate to tell you that the Milgram experiments and the Stanford Prison experiments, they have not held up well to scrutiny.
I don't remember those, but yes.
Okay, good. Well, then we won't repeat them. But what has held up well is everything that pointed to social identity being this major factor. The great sociologist Brooke Harrington told me, and that was what you just mentioned, that if there was an E=mc² of social science, it would be social death is greater than physical death.
Mm.
That if it is your identity, or your, probably more properly put, your reputation that is at stake, you would rather your physical body die than the sort of the representation you have in the minds of others that we call reputation.
If you have a good reputation, so overpowering. Why is that?
Well,
it's
because because we're a group, we live in a very, in America, in the West.
And is this American? Is this a Western?
No, it's human. It's very human, very primate is what this is. Because, but we do have a culture in the United States and in the West in general, in the modern era, that is very individualistic. And I think that we like to think of ourselves as being islands, and that we actively choose who we are, what we feel, what we do, and we're not being influenced at all times by cultural forces. None of that's true, but it's a feeling we have as a culture, and I understand why we have it. But the truth is, everything happening to you is all your thoughts, feelings, and behaviors are being deeply influenced by the people around you, and the dynamics of the microculture in your home, and then the culture in your community, and the culture in your region, and so on. So much so that if you were to move to another location in the United States within a year, many of your values and attitudes and beliefs would start to shift very dramatically just from being around other people who see things differently. I know people don't think that would happen, but the research is pretty clear on that. And there's one of my favorite studies of all times was they had these dudes they had them fill out a questionnaire and they had to walk down to the end of, they had some blood drawn, and then they had to go to the end of a hallway and hand in the questionnaire and the blood that was drawn. But unbeknownst to them, there was a door halfway through there to go into a lab, and they had an actor who was going to come out and pretend that they didn't see the person walking to the end, and they bumped it together, but they gave a big shoulder bump. And then they look in the eye, and the actor says, "Asshole," and then he walks away. And then when they turned in the questionnaire, they draw blood again. And the actual study taking place was to see how did that affect people's cortisol levels and adrenaline and all that kind of stuff from the shoulder bump. So there's all men, and the variable was that some of these men were people who had lived most of their lives in the northern United States, and some of these were men who had lived most of their lives in the southern part of the United States. And what they found were that when they did the debrief, the men from the north said, they're like, what do you think about the guy that bumped you? And like, he was like, yeah, what an idiot. Who cares? Like, it was laughable. They thought it was a joke. And their cortisol levels weren't really changed. Their adrenaline levels really weren't changed. The men who grew up in the South, when they ask, like, what did you think of that person? They're like, man, any other day of the week, man, I think I might have hurt that man. I might have put that man on the ground.
Wow.
How dare he? And then their cortisol levels, their blood levels were maxed out. They really went into, I'm getting ready to fight and murder another human being because this is a moment where I've been challenged just from a simple insult and thing. There's a great book on this called The Culture of Honor by Dove Cohen, and it illustrates that this cultural lag that's taken place. Most people in the southern United States, the culture that sort of started that region up as its micro-civilizations were herding cultures from regions in the UK where people, their livelihood was based off livestock. And one of the, unlike farming cultures, livestock cultures can have their livelihood stolen by rustlers. And so they need to portray to the surrounding culture that if you cross me, the retribution will be immense, which is a way to deter people from stealing in the first place. Nobody's doing that anymore, but that cultural value has persisted, and it still exists to the point that if you insult a Southerner in any way, I know this personally because I grew up in the Deep South, and when I am in New York and someone honks at me, I get very angry.
Is that right?
There's nothing I can do about it. It just happens. Then I have to think, no, you know better. There's no reason to think this way.
Yeah. I'm wondering even about the layer of cortisol in general, that we're all pretty anxiety ridden. We're all stressed out. And so I wonder how much of that plays into the laziness that you had referenced before.
Yeah.
Of changing somebody's mind, or even, the groupthink, of it is geographical, but that's a whole nother layer of, how we process information, how we connect with each other from just
stress
levels.
I use this as an example because I want to, and I apologize for interrupting because I'm just very excited about this.
No, you're good.
This is your show, David. Okay, cool.
This is your episode.
I use this as an example to just illustrate how absolutely bound we are to culture and how bound we are to social concepts, conventions, and the influence of people around us. I mean, your body, the molecules inside your body change, and you have nothing you can. You have no control over it. I mean, if I was bumped in that hallway, I can imagine being like, and there are other people who grew up in other regions who don't have that response. So naive realism would lead me to believe that that's not natural. Like the default response is my response, and the other person thinks the same thing. So I use as an example to just to illustrate how deeply bound we are to culture and social concepts. Because the reason for that is because we are we survived in groups, and this is the long answer to your previous question about why would social death be greater than physical death? Mm-hmm. Because we survived as a species by caring more about the health of the group than we did about any individual within the group. And if it comes to it, if we need to sacrifice ourselves for the group, we have innate propensities toward that. And everything from war to running into a burning building to save a child, these are things that are innate to us. Anything like shame or embarrassment or any feelings in that domain are parts of the system that helped us survive as groups. And there was a lot of intergroup conflict, which our group wasn't the only group. We lived in small bands of about 150 or fewer people for most of our evolution as both proto-humans and early humans. So there was a lot of, we needed to constantly signal, are you in my group? Or are you in some other group?
Mm-hmm.
And my shame and embarrassment and feelings of my fear of ostracism are only directed toward people in my group. I don't care how you feel about me because I'm not going to be ostracized from your group. And ostracism in that environment is death. I mean, if you're kicked, if you live in the Serengeti or the jungle or the desert or any place environment like that, and you're kicked out of your group, you're dead. It's over for you. So you need to constantly be concerned about your reputation within your community. And so reputation management is one of the highest motivations in the human psyche. And oftentimes what's happening when you are arguing with another person, what you're actually witnessing on their end is reputation management. They are very concerned about how the outcome of this interaction is going to play when it is interpreted by people within their trusted group. They call them affinity groups in psychology, but they're trusted peer group. So
you need to stop right there. So reputation management is all the way at the very top of this. So if we're thinking about how do I change somebody's mind, knowing that reputation management is the highest, how do you methodically pursue that goal?
Okay, this is where I'll get into it. And I want to really emphasize how true this is. There are cultures where people commit suicide out of shame. There are moments in our own, in Western United States culture where people will end their lives out of shame. There are people who have refused to get vaccinated and on their deathbed, the last thing they're going to give up is their belief that vaccines are dangerous, or the last thing they're going to do is even admit they have COVID if they are part of a community where that signals their loyalty to the group. And the same is true for fact-based statements. Like, if you're a flat earther, the last thing you can do is admit that the earth is not flat because that kicks you out of the group. I mean, so your reputation management and your adherence to wanting to stay within the group of trusted peers is going to be far more powerful as a motivation than the pursuit of truth or even the pursuit of your own mortality. That's how high it is. So, which means that when you engage in a persuasive attempt,
David, we're fucked.
We're not.
Okay.
We're not because we know this, which means that I say this in the book, and I'm paraphrasing myself, so I don't know how I exactly put it, but I believe this is something.
That's okay. We're all going to read it.
This is something I fundamentally believe, which
we'll all fact check you.
Okay, cool. When you get frustrated over the fact that you can't change people's minds, when you get frustrated that people believe things that you don't, and you don't seem to be able to bring them over to your way, when you get frustrated that you have political values that you can't seem to get other people to get on board with, your frustration is always directed at the other person. And I'm sorry, but you're the problem. You are frustrated. It's like being frustrated that you can't get to the moon because all you ever try to use to get there is a ladder. Like, you're using poor techniques and poor tools and you're failing. And then you're blaming that on the other person being dumb or stupid or evil or misguided or brainwashed.
That's an interesting reframe too, because I think that is how people feel. Like, why is that person so dumb? Why don't they, if they saw, you know, you said it before, if they knew what I knew, they wouldn't believe that.
Right. I understand, because if you don't know what you don't know, and if you don't know that there are ways of talking to people that are much more likely to reach the ends you're trying to get to, then sure, I can see why the last thing you want to do is blame yourself. I understand. But let's talk about the first thing. the highest motivation is reputation management, because our strongest fear is ostracism. That means the very first thing you have to do, if we had to break these into steps, step one, I would say step zero is ask yourself why you want to do this. But then step one is going to be build rapport or establish rapport. Because if anything you communicate to the other person can be interpreted as you should be ashamed for thinking that, you should be ashamed for feeling that, you should be ashamed for believing that, you should be ashamed that that value is where it is, and then that's it. The conversation's over. Because if they sense that they will be shamed for changing their minds, or they sense that that being shamed is going to be an outcome of this interaction, that they're going to avoid it more than they would avoid a knife in your hand. They will. There is great research by Sarah Gimbel and a group of neuroscientists. They put people on an MRI and they challenged their beliefs about a variety of different issues. One was like, did Thomas Edison invent the light bulb, or can you see the Great Wall of China from space? And then they would ask them how strongly they believe that. And then they would show them like, actually Thomas Edison didn't invent the light bulb, or you can see all sorts of stuff from space, not just the Great Wall of China. And in fact, the Great Wall of China is not that easy to see from space. Little trivia facts like that. People would go, oh, I didn't know that. And the brain scanner would notice how much blood was going into different regions of the brain. It was pretty normal. But if you challenge them on something like, should there be gun control, or, and they'd ask the question something like, they would say, it would be like abortion rights or gun control. They'd ask them similar fact-based statements within those domains. Some of those statements would be things that people on both sides of the issue believe are factual, but are not actually true. And then they would challenge them about those. When those issues were challenged, the amount of blood that would rush into the default mode network of the brain was the same. This is exactly what Sarah Gimbel told me. It looked exactly like what would happen if they had suddenly confronted a bear in the woods. They had an intense visceral bodily reaction, because that motivation that they're avoiding the fear of ostracism. They're avoiding the death of their social identity as strongly as they would be feeling like a threat to their physical body. And that's going to happen. And we've probably all experienced this in a debate with someone who challenges something that we feel very strong about, right? Then the strong feeling of feeling strongly about an issue is the feeling that you may lose some reputation points and that you may be ostracized. For the most part, for most of the issues that I would consider wedge issues, that's actually what's taking place. It's not true for everything, but true for a lot of them, right? So the first thing you need to do is establish rapport. You need to assure the other person not out to shame them, and ask for consent to explore their reasoning. There's several different techniques. In street epistemology, you assure the other person that you're not out to shame them. And you want to explore the reasoning. This is the same true as in smart politics, same is true in smart politics and deep canvassing. It's the same first step in all three. And Misha Globerman, who is a negotiation communication expert, he opened my eyes to the fact that establishing rapport may not happen in just one conversation. Your history with the other person has to be taken into account. If this is your dad or your mom or your sister, and you're not on great terms with them, you have to get to a place where you can talk about issues before you jump right in, because they may consider you a them, not as a family member, but as they have this subculture that they're a part of and their reputation is tied to and their identity is tied to. And if they consider you outside of that, you're in another group, they have no interest in ingratiating themselves to you. And they also suffer enormous social costs for taking on ideas they know will signal to their group that they may be a traitor.
Defecting, right.
Yeah. So you must establish rapport. And to establish rapport, you have to do the best way to establish rapport at the level of a primate is to engage in activities or engage in conversations that sort of take on the veneer of reaching a common goal together. You can do that in conversation by saying, "Hey, what do you think about this this new tax bill coming down the line?" You can both get on the same page of hating the IRS or something, right? "Hey, I need help with installing this new sink doodad, or I could you I have to cook this meal for this reason, and I have just so much time. Could you help out with it? There are all sorts of things you can do that will put you into a dynamic with the other person in which you're working on a shared goal. And there's nothing unethical about that, especially if you're actually trying to reach to do something that you could use the other person's help. With my dad, we installed a winch on my truck, and this is directly from the research. That's the reason I did it. I was like, I need to go do something with my dad where we work together in a way that has nothing to do with our subcultures and our politics and stuff.
You have opposing politics.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, he's still in Mississippi. He's still, you know, he's got a lot of values that I don't, and a lot of. He's beholden to groups that I am not.
Okay.
So, but you can also do that with a stranger, like, you know, establishing rapport up early, early on in the conversation. You just are things like, you know, just simply being nice, and mainly you want to show the other person that you're going to listen to them. You're going to see them. You're going to, you actually are interested in what they have to say. You're not just waiting, getting ammunition to shoot at them within their heart and their beliefs and stuff. So the ability of rapport is immensely important, that first step. And frame the conversation after that is going to be, you and I are going to try to solve a mystery together. And the mystery is going to be, how did you come to this conclusion? Or what is underlying your confidence in the issue? Ask for consent, ask for lots of consent. And, once you have that, you can move on to the second step. So I have notes over here because there are three different techniques, but I can tell you that they all pretty much work the same way, which is, but it depends on what you're working on. Let's say it's vaccine hesitancy. What you're really working on there is an attitude. So you're going to want to move into sort of motivational interviewing techniques, and you're going to want to move sort of directly to their intentions for behavior. But if it was a fact-based thing, like is the earth flat or something, then you could just ask for a claim. So either way, you'd want to sort of in the beginning, if, let's say you're trying to work on a behavior, you want somebody to vaccinate, you'd say on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely are you to do that? If you are working on a fact-based claim, a belief, you would say, okay, and you would ask that up front, like what is it that you believe we'd like to talk about today? And let's say they think that karma determines the fate of all human actions, or that the moon is actually a secret Nazi space station. That's a real conversation I had with someone once. you would ask on a scale from 1 to 10, how strongly do you believe that? These scales are very important in the beginning because they quantify your emotional response, they quantify your confidence, they quantify where you are on a scale of positive or negative valence on the attitude, right? This is such an important step because this engages the other person in metacognition. And I was talking about the difference between technique rebuttal and topic rebuttal. Topic rebuttal is when you just, topic rebuttal is fine when you're like a lawyer or a scientist or an engineer or an academic of some kind. When both people are on the same page as far as like they're playing by the same rules, which means they share the same epistemology, they're using the same method to come to the conclusions that they come to, then you can just lob facts at each other. It's safe in those worlds because you're using the same epistemology. Plus you trust each other, it's vetted, and you have other people who are going to check your notes. It is expected. And I would note that's also safe in those groups because you suffer no shame for doing so. In fact, you get social points for engaging this kind of behavior in those environments. The technique rebuttal, on the other hand, is asking a person to explore their own reasoning chain, which is what I feel like you should stay in. So the Socratic method is an example of a technique rebuttal. And these other persuasive techniques are sort of taking the Socratic method and adding things we've learned from psychology and neuroscience and everything in between to give them a more robust and easy to follow step-by-step paint by numbers thing. So yeah, I'd ask the from 1 to 10, where they are on that scale. This helps them engage in metacognition. They'll start thinking about their own thinking. And for most people, we've never done this. Let's do it. We can do this together. Okay.
Okay.
Allison, what's the last full length movie you watched?
Encanto.
So did you like it? Or
I loved it.
On a scale from 1 to 10, what would you rate it?
I thought it was a 10.
Well, why a 10 and not like say an 8?
I think because it addressed so many social values in a way that became so relatable to each character. So each character had special gifts that they were given, some magical gifts. And those magical gifts, they felt like if they didn't have those magical gifts, they would not be special. And I felt, and there was one family member that was not blessed with gifts and felt like she was special because she was around it, but really struggled with what is her gift. And I just felt like it was very universal.
Is this, you watch a lot of movies like that?
Sometimes I have kids, so the Disney movies are.
if you think that character hadn't been in the movie and it was just about gifts and stuff, they didn't have that subplot, do you think you'd still give it a 10?
Probably not. I felt like the cartoon aspect of it was made it universal, made it palatable for both adults and children, where the message was strong. But if it was a regular movie, I think it would probably be a little more difficult to achieve.
So I'll stop here because you can see, like, we're already doing it, right? Do you see how this changes the way we talk about anything? Like, I change it from the movie to some topic that's contentious.
Yeah.
And by asking,
I was afraid of what you were going
to
ask.
No, I was feeling myself about to. I did this with a FBI agent once, and we got into like some deep stuff, and I was like, wow, this is, you have to be careful with this technique. I have a really good story about the end of the book that I'd like to share with you when we sum things up about how I chose not to use this technique, and I put it in the book as an example of when you should and shouldn't use it. But notice that when we were talking just then, it was very easy to get your number, right? Boom. Even if you had never really considered how you feel about it, it could be something that you, let's say you love tiramisu. And I was like, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much would you say you love it? And you might, somebody might be like, I don't know, an 8. And those feelings, if a person says 0 or 10, you can pretty much guarantee they haven't thought about it very much. Cause there's really no, such thing as being a 0 or a 10, but that's really a very like binary black, white, one all or nothing kind of thing. And we don't generally have that feeling about anything, even like the people we love in our lives. You know, we're not at 100, we're still hard 99. You know,
there are
things, but like if they're not 0 or 10, if they're somewhere in the middle, you can see that little hesitation, like that moment's important. There's metacognition taking place. Give it a little bit. They're feeling that for the first time and trying to quantify it and trying to put it in, they're trying to articulate the ineffable. Then if you take it one, so this is, that's important, that engages that active processing. And then the next step is you say, you're asking for their reasoning. I just asked you to justify that to me. So you started going into that thing, like you were thinking about reputation management. You're trying to create a reason for why you thought, felt, and believed that I would find plausible, but more importantly, people in your trusted peer group would find plausible, is defensible to the people whose opinions you care about. That's fine. I want you to do that. We are now entering an actual conversation about this that can go somewhere, because we can solve the mystery together of why you actually feel this way. I'm going to help you get to what actually led to that feeling that you're having. But what's great is we often in our initial volley, we come up with just the most biased and lazy thing we can think of to explain how we feel.
I'm sure I'm guilty.
There's something in psychology called the toupee effect, which is we only notice things that suck when the thing that sucks is salient and noticeable. So, and that'll become our reason for not liking something. So like people would like, I think when people didn't like the Star Wars prequels, they would say like, oh, they just look like a video game. Like that's the toupee effect, you know, we're like, that's the most salient thing and I can blame. But at the same, or they'll say, well, they won't even say that. They'll say there's too much CGI in it. Like I remember that the Transformers movies, they're like, it's too much CGI in it. But then like, you know, they love the Avengers movies and that's like, it's basically a cartoon.
Right.
Right. So that's not it. That's, or they'll say the CGI was bad. It's the thing that you notice, that you can notice, becomes the thing that is the reason for, you know, that they'll say CGI sucks, and that's why I don't like movies like that. But see, the only CGI that you say sucks is the CGI that you can notice. If it's not noticeable, then you forget about it. So when you produce a reason for why you think you don't believe, I know as the person on the other side of this, that that's probably not the actual reason. That's just the first one that, that you put out, because that's how we operate. That's how we use, that's how social dynamics work. So what I'm going to do is accept that. I'm not going to make you feel weird. I'm going to repeat it back to you. I'm going to paraphrase. I'm going to reflect. And then I'm going to go a step further into it and try to get deeper into it to find the real reason for why we're doing this, because you probably don't know it. Most of us don't know the, and this is the core principle of You Are Not So Smart, my podcast and everything, is that the antecedents of our thoughts, feelings, behaviors are outside of our outside of our introspection powers, which means the narratives we generate to explain ourselves to ourselves are mostly fictional, but we live by those narratives, and that's pretty much
that's the, so crazy that's, that that's our memories are mostly fictional.
That's the introspection illusion in a nutshell. It's easy to come up with an explanation for yourself, but that explanation is almost always just sort of a very PR-based fictional narrative that makes you feel good about who you are. That's fine. So after this 1 to 10 thing, after I get you to talk to me a little bit, these are some really good questions. If it's about behavior, like vaccination, you would ask a person if they're very, let's say I asked you, how likely are you to vaccinate? And you said you're like a 2 out of a scale of 1 to 10. I could ask, why not lower? This is a motivation reframe technique, because
why not lower?
Because you didn't say 0, which means that you have a little bit of something in there. And it's very important that I don't get you talking about all the reasons you wouldn't vaccinate. That's not what we're talking about here. I want you to talk to me about reasons you would. So I ask you, why not lower? Because now I've directed the conversation so that you can explore, why didn't you say 0? Because you didn't say 0. And we can get into it from there. And now you're going to start introspecting and coming up with reasons, much similar to the way you were talking about that movie. With a fact-based claim, it may be okay to say, why not higher? You know, if you do you think UFOs, aliens, and this person says, yeah, I'm kind of a 7 on that. Well, that's not a 10. So I would say, why weren't you higher? Because you see the intentions are a little different on my end of what we're trying to explore.
Yeah.
Other things from
fascinating.
This.
Fascinating.
It would take forever to go through all of it, but that's a good way to just get started. I think anybody could use those to get started. It's also important to clarify definitions during these conversations. If another person and I are talking about politics, in my mind, politics might be representative democracy, where people get together and the ideals of the founding fathers, whatever I think. The other person might think politics is just a group of people in cigars in a dark room dividing up the country in little pieces before golf. Like your definition and my definition may be different. And so when we're using the same words, actually be having the conversation that we think we're having. So it's very important to always clarify definitions. And when the other person clarifies their definitions, use their definitions, not yours. And then the main point here is ask what reasons they have to hold their level of confidence, or ask what reasons they have to do or do not engage in a behavior or feel a certain thing. And then just work that out deeper and deeper. And the last thing you want to do is ask, like, how did you come to that level of confidence? Like, what method are you using to reach that level of confidence? And you just listen and you summarize and you repeat. And what will happen naturally is the other person on their own, in a very safe way, in a very private way, they will feel that feeling of cognitive dissonance that will lead them to want to resolve it so that they can update their reasoning to reach an actual conclusion. What might be happening in this conversation is they form their first true opinion. They didn't even have an opinion about this until the conversation. They were just operating sort of on an autopilot opinion that they assumed they had. We can believe we have an opinion and we can believe we've thought something out and live by that, and honestly not even have ever really deeply considered it. And in the consideration of it, oftentimes we will update and change our minds. And it's also important to remember, if you change by 2%, that's change. Change is a 2% change can lead to a 80% change later. If your goal in a conversation is to completely flip someone or 180 them, like, you're really going to get disappointed. That happens sometimes, but it's the little bit of change, the incremental change, is what you're aiming for. What you're aiming for most of all is to continue the conversation. Like hopefully you'll have 12 conversations about this, and things really get interesting there. And if you're doing one of those internet arguments where you just want to like drop bombs on people and walk away, you're never going to have another. You're going to burn out from that conversation eventually and be like, agree to disagree. Like, and that's what I would avoid most of all.
Oh my goodness.
It's fine to agree to disagree. It's not fine to walk away from the conversation. I want you to have a different perspective than I do. I want you to have values that are different from mine. I want you to have experiences and anxieties and fears that don't match mine, because I want to add your perspective to my perspective to get to the truth of the matter. And it's in the combination of these perspectives that's the only way we have any opportunity to understand what's going on around us. And then these kinds of persuasive techniques are going to, as you are engaging with the other person, you're going to change too. That's the thing. You both update your priors to a better understanding of the nature of what's going on around us. That's what makes it ethical and moral and okay in my mind.
David, you just built a bridge to answer the question, honestly, of how do we connect? Like, how do we unite? How do we come together? Is it possible? To me, it seems like it is a little bit Pollyanna to think, you know, we're going to come together. It just seems so freaking polarized, but you just laid out a bridge. So I thank you for that. Tell me, what do you know that you wish other people could know through all this study, through all of this research, through all of this thought?
No one is unpersuadable. No one is unreachable. No one, there's no such thing. Like, there's no one who is beyond change, yourself included. There's nothing you think, feel, and believe right now that couldn't use a little work, especially the things you feel very confident about. You don't know what you're wrong about. You don't know what you don't know. The people on the other side of an issue that you feel strongly about are people who believe things that are not supported by the evidence. No matter how unreachable they may seem, that's not the case. There's no such thing. If we couldn't change our minds, as Hugo Mercier told me, if we couldn't change our minds, arguing wouldn't exist. We wouldn't have evolved this ability. In the same way that if we couldn't see, then we would eventually evolve eyes away. We'd be like some sort of cave-dwelling fish that doesn't need eyes, which exist. So the fact that we can change and can persuade other people and can solve the mysteries of how we come to conclusions and sort of try to figure out what is the better way to go about living in this very complex and chaotic epistemic environment that we find ourselves within in the modern era, just because all these things are frustrating, it doesn't mean that they're impassable. I feel that very strongly. And I'm very optimistic, to the point of almost being a Pollyanna about all this stuff. But I feel like, you know, we're just living in an era of new technology, new cultural conventions as a result of that technology. And this has happened many times through human history. And we just are lucky or unlucky, depending on your perspective, to be the ones that have to sort it out. And it'll probably be a 3 or 4 generational spread of becoming, of building a literacy for these, this new epistemic environment.
Wow. 3 or 4 generations.
I say we got about 100 years of work to do. But each generation is going to do a little bit of that work together, and we'll figure it out. And some institutions will survive. Some will not. Some cultural concepts will survive. Some will not. Some norms will shift drastically and some won't. And at the end of it, we will, this madness period of time, this chaos period of time, this period of time where it seems like the truth is in question, it'll sort itself out. We'll find the level. But because this has happened many times, this happened with the printing press, this happened with written language, this happened with the invention of complex economic environments, this happened with the advent of trains, this happened with the advent of steam, this happened with the advent of the Industrial Revolution. This has happened. We've got VHS tapes. this keeps happening. And we always sort it out. That's not to say that in that cultural line of change, there were wars and there were revolutions and there were all sorts of horrible outcomes that took place and all that.
And I'm thinking about Thanksgiving dinner, you know, like I'm thinking of how to do this. You know, like if it is the 3 or 4 generation span, it is a long-term collective evolution that has to happen. And I'm thinking about, you know, how do we do this in our interpersonal lives? So I thank you for putting the framework, because I think we want to figure out, where is our place in the story? Can we make this better in a way where we don't feel attacked too?
Okay, I have a quote from my science hero, James Burke, for this. I'm going to paraphrase him because I don't have it in front of me. But James Burke said, there's nothing in this world that you can't understand as long as it's explained to you clearly enough. And so with that in mind, what is it that you should try to understand? And he said, well, whatever it is that you want to change about the world, that's where you should start. I believe that very strongly. I don't think that anything is outside our grasp.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything outside our grasp. And if there's something in this world that you feel like maybe you have, maybe where you position in the world, you have a unique, you understand it better than other people. Like, if you're LGBT, you know about LGBT issues and people don't. If you're a person of color, same thing, right? If you're a person who works in tech or a startup, you know the problems there that other people might not. You might be aware of problems in the world that you think need solving, or changes you think to take place, that you are privileged in a sort of upside down kind of way, privileged to have a front row seat to those things. And to change them, you need to understand them deeply. Or maybe you just recently learned about something that you are appalled by, or that you feel like could improve the general tenor of the human experience. That's the thing you need to try to become pretty up to date on. And there's nothing about that you can't understand and try to change. And then once you have that, I recommend looking into the science of persuasion and how people actually change. Or
your book, How Minds Change.
Yeah.
Tell us.
And at the end of all that, buy this great book I just heard about.
Yeah. How can people find you and consume your work? How can people buy the book?
Yeah, you can pre-order the book everywhere. It's just called How Minds Change. You can keep up with my stuff. I have a biweekly, every other week podcast called You Are Not So Smart. That's also the name of my first book.
I love the name of what is the other book?
You Are Now Less Dumb is the sequel.
So smart.
But all my stuff is under You Are Not So Smart. And the you in that, of course, is me and everyone else included. It's a universal you. And it's all about unity through humility. It comes from understanding just how bizarre we are. We are a person. And then you can find me on Twitter at David McGrain. My website with all that stuff on it, keep up with all the stuff, and pre-order directly from it. It's just davidmcgrain.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, David. This was fantastic. You're solving problems.
Problems. I only endeavor to solve more problems than I create. If I can just back this out, good to go.
That's a good one. Thank you. What I loved about David is his unrelenting pursuit of how people's minds work and the science behind persuasion. His work is ever fascinating and so, so freaking helpful. I highly recommend you grab his book, How Minds Change, and subscribe to his podcast, You Are Not So Smart. I've linked it in the show notes. As for me, thank you for your kind reactions to last week's solo cast on my origin story. I've got some really incredible stories about big ass changes coming up in this series. So make sure you're subscribed, leave a review while you're there, and share the series. If you want more, follow me on Instagram and at AllisonHair.com. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.